Welcome to the Ask Your Mentor podcast from Dementia Researcher and Alzheimer's Research UK, where mentees interview their mentors to hear about their careers, experiences, and to find out what makes them tick.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask Your Mentor podcast. My name is Dr. Nicoleta Dasculidou, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the UK Dementia Research Institute at Cardiff University. Here, I'm in Professor Paul Morgan's group, investigating complement biology in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. My research goal is to explore the impact of Alzheimer's disease-associated complement gene polymorphism. I'm investigating the mechanism by which risk variants impact complement component expression and function and predisposition to Alzheimer's disease using stem cell technology. I'm also an early career researcher representative at our institute. You probably already know that in this podcast, we discuss the importance of mentoring and how it can positively impact your personal and professional growth. We discuss why having a mentor is essential, how to find the right mentor, and what makes a good mentor-mentee relationship. But the real highlight is hearing from brilliant mentors who have very kindly volunteered their time through the Alzheimer's Research UK mentoring program to help the next generation of dementia researchers. Today, our special guest is my mentor, Professor Heather Mortebois from the University of Sheffield. So whether you're a seasoned academic or just starting out, you won't want to miss this conversation. Let's dive in and learn from the best. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Nicoleta.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be here. These shows are all about recognizing that there is no such thing as a standard career path. So we start each one by asking our mentors to take us through their CV. So we're going to go through each role and discuss career moves, how this came about, some of the thought processes that were going on at the time, achievements and lessons taken from each role. So Heather, you finished your undergrad in Sheffield in 2001. And then you don't stay in Sheffield or the North or even in the country. You leave for Germany to jump straight into your PhD. That's a big move. How did that come about? Can you take us through those early days through to finishing your PhD, please?
So I did my undergraduate at Sheffield. And then I really knew that I wanted to do a PhD. I definitely wanted to be in academic research. But I also knew that I wanted to get a different experience out of my PhD. I wanted to have the opportunity to see what research culture was like in a different country, in a different type of setting. And so I looked for PhDs that were at international institutes. So like the Max Planck Institutes, of which there are many in Germany, or other types of institutes that they are across mainland Europe. And so then I found that the Max Planck's actually run an international PhD program. And so I applied to actually a new Max Planck Institute as it was then that had not long been set up in Dresden, which was the Max Planck Institute for Cell Biology and Genetics. And so I applied to their international PhD program. And I applied to other international institutes across Europe, and I also applied to some PhDs in the UK. But I was fortunate enough to get invited to the week-long interview process at the MPI in Dresden. And then I was fortunate enough to be offered the PhD there. And I'm really so glad that I did that, that early stage in my career, straight from undergraduate going into my PhD, because it really open my eyes to the institute research culture, which I think is a little bit different from being in a university department. But I kind of had the best of both worlds because the Max Planck Institute was affiliated with the university, and in particular the university clinic. And so the other thing that I was really certain on from the outset is I wanted my PhD to have some translational aspect. And so that was fantastic, being associated with the university clinic and also the Max Planck Institute.
I can relate to that experience, actually, because I also moved abroad for my PhD. I did my first degree in my home country in Greece, studying molecular biology at the fourth year we have a Socrates Erasmus program, and I decided to join the program, and I was selected to undertake my final year project in the UK. So it was a great experience. I moved to Liverpool, and then I managed to extend this by securing another European studentship that was called the Leonardo da Vinci program at the time. And well, I really enjoyed the experience because it's been 15 years since then. I'm still in the UK. And I also jumped straight into my PhD, actually, after this position. Were you a first-generation student? What did your family think about your career choices?
So I was the first in my family to go to full-time university. So a couple of people in the family had gone to university that they'd done on top of working full-time, which I can't imagine how they did that. So I was the first to go to full-time university, and certainly the first and only one to have gone on to do a PhD. And also in an area which is out of the comfort zone from the rest of my family. So no one else in my family is in medicine, biology, academic research. Everyone's an engineer. That's the background of the family. But having said that, I could not have even done my undergraduate in Sheffield, let alone have moved to Germany for my PhD and everything else that I've done since then, without my family's support. So my parents have always been very, very supportive, and have basically just taught me from a very young age that if I want something, then I can just go and do it, that there's no boundaries or barriers for me to do that.
That's amazing. I was as fortunate as you that my parents were like that too. I forgot to ask you about the language. Did you speak German when you moved to Germany?
I did speak some German, a little bit of German, but it most definitely was nowhere near fluent. And I think that's one of the biggest things that you really get from moving abroad and taking that leap, is there is no better way to learn a language.
That's true.
And I think having that additional language skill is always a bonus. So it was daunting at times, but fantastic.
And I'm
so
were there any classes offered or anything for students joining?
There were some classes. I actually didn't do them. The language at the Max Planck Institute is English, and so everything in there is in English. Obviously, to live outside of that, you need to be able to speak German. So I didn't take any classes. I just kind of improved my German by having to speak and communicate to people.
Do you have any specific advice for PhD students? I mean, what skills should they gain during this period? What do you think? And also what advice would you give for someone considering pursuing a PhD in this specific field?
I think the key thing for me, for any PhD student, when you're looking to start a PhD, is you need to be motivated about the topic that you're going to study. So your supervisor and the support you have from elsewhere can only get you so far. If it's not something that you really, really want to study and you're motivated and passionate about, then it's going to be very difficult. And I think the other thing is, don't just think about the project. Actually think about what the environment's like. Think about the institution that you'll be joining, whether it's a research institute, whether it's a university department. Think about the actual group. How big is the group? How small is the group? Is that the way that you like to work? How much support would you have, not only from your supervisor, but from others within that team? I think often students think very much about the science, which is absolutely important, but so is the actual situation that you'll be in, and the group, research institution and the group.
Great advice, thank you. So then you go back to academia, you decided to pursue a career in academia. What drew you to this decision?
I have to say, at that point, after finishing my PhD, I didn't really consider any other path than going into academia. I wanted to have my own research group. I wanted to be a PI. I wanted to be able to decide what I found interesting and write grants to get money. Perhaps I rather naively didn't understand how difficult it was at times to get those grants. But I didn't really consider anything else. I knew that I wanted to move back to the UK for a time. And so then I was looking for postdoc positions back in the UK. And I was also relatively focused on wanting to work in Parkinson's disease and wanting to work on mitochondria. So I had completely been bitten by the mitochondrial bug during my PhD. And so that was definitely something I wanted to work on. And so then I did manage to come back to the UK and get a postdoc position working on Parkinson's and mitochondria.
You know, when you moved back to the UK, was it easy for you to go back to this workplace? I mean, if you compare it to your previous role in Germany?
I mean, I think any move is always a bit difficult. And even if it's not between countries, if you're going to a different lab, you're going to a different institution, you need time to sort of bed in and settle in and get going there. But I don't think it was any more difficult or any easier than any other move.
Can you take us through the next steps, actually, your postdocs and what you believe what you gain from its position?
So as I said, I moved back to the UK to a postdoc position, and that in itself is a decision point, because I was offered two different positions. One was for a longer time period, and it was working with an industry partner, and another one then was for only 12 months, but it was working in the research area that I wanted to work in Parkinson's and mitochondria. So I took a gamble and I took the shorter contract. And a lot of people at the time thought that perhaps wasn't the right move. But it paid off because I did start that contract on only a 12-month contract, but we were successful enough to get enough pilot data within the first few months, which was a lot of hard slog upon setting everything up when I got there. But we were successful enough to get a research grant, which then funded me for a 3-year postdoc position. And so that's really when I really started thinking about what do I need to do to put myself into a position to get that academic PI position that I want. And so I began investigating the fellowship route, what fellowships were on offer, what funders looked for in a fellow, the different levels of fellowship that were on offer, and obviously discussing that with people internally and externally about how to get my CV in the right shape for that. And that was a process which took years. So I already started thinking about that, you know, just at the beginning of year two of my postdoc. And so then I had the 3-year postdoc position and I had a maternity leave break during that postdoc position. And then coming back from that, I finished off that postdoc and then I had I got another postdoc in the same group position. But meanwhile, I was then actively applying for fellowships. And putting projects together. Mm-hmm. I was gaining small pots of research funding. I was, you know, all of the other stuff that you need to have on your CV. I was actively pursuing that. And so then I was successful in getting a senior research fellowship from Parkinson's UK, which started in 2013. So 10 years ago now. And that was really the funding, the opportunity that enabled me to start my own research group.
How long was that for the funding, for how many years?
So it started off as being 3-year funding. Mm-hmm. And actually I had a second maternity leave break during that 3-year funding. For that fellowship, and then they have the option of applying for a 2-year additional funding.
Okay.
Which I did, and I was successful in getting as well.
Sounds like a very busy time. It's impressive that you managed to balance all that and, you know, maternity leave and everything. Wow. So how many years in total did you do as a postdoc?
So that was from 2006 until 2013 with the 1-year mat leave break.
Yeah, less than 7 years. Is there a specific experience you would like to share that you think would be useful for the ECRs during these roles?
I think I look back to that time when I was applying for fellowships, and actually I think there was the start of a lot of support for people applying for fellowships, both from the funders and from the institutions. And I think that support has only increased in the intervening time period. So I would say to people, it's never too early to think about it and make sure that you avail yourself of all of that support and all of that learning which is there. And if I could go on to just extrapolate from that one piece of advice, when you are then successful in getting your fellowship, it can be that support then doesn't appear to be there when you're a new fellow. So that I think there's quite a lot of support for when you people are applying to fellowships and trying to get fellowships. And then there is less still, but there is more than there used to be for people then who are in fellowship positions. Okay. So I think, you know, even now as a professor, I still think about what support I might need, what networks I might need. And so I think that's important to avail yourself of the support that's available and find the support that's available at every stage.
As you actually know, I've started applying a few months ago, and it was always a big thing for me. But then when you actually start writing, then everything comes together and you realize how much support you have and that people are willing to support you. They contacted people and set up collaborations in the UK, in the USA, in Belgium. Everyone was positive and happy to help and be involved. It was amazing. And then I just thought, why haven't I started this earlier? I mean, I had the experience to do that. But yeah, you're right. It's just amazing. But thanks for the tip about when you actually get the fellowship. Do you ever think about any of your choices and regret them?
No. I think about my choices, certainly. Regret them? No. Even if I think, oh, you know, maybe one way of looking at that would be that it was not the right choice, I actually try to turn it around and think there's always some positive learnings to take from whatever choice.
And it's what shapes you really to what you are now and what is. So, yeah. What do you think, you mentioned some, but what do you think are the biggest challenges you faced during your academic career from your early years until now? And how did you actually overcome them?
I think that I won't be the only person who's in an academic career and thinks that one of the biggest issues is the short-term, fixed-term contracts. Of extremely highly skilled labour to have short-term fixed-term contracts, especially when you're thinking about then that you actually have a life outside of your work combined into that. So I think that's one of the biggest issues that I faced and that everyone else in this space faces as well. And I mean, as to how I overcame that, I'm not sure anyone can actually really overcome that. You can try and plan, you can try and be prepared, you can try and have discussions with PIs, line managers, heads of department as early as you possibly can. But I don't think there's any way in which at the moment that can be overcome.
Have you ever considered transitioning from academia to industry or other sectors? And if so, what factors influence your decision to stay in academia?
I don't think I've ever really seriously considered transitioning to industry, maybe for a fleeting moment. And I work a lot with industry, and I have done for a number of years now. So a good proportion of my team are via industry academic collaborations. And so I have a lot of respect for those industry partners, for the way in which they operate and they do their scientific research. But no, I don't think I've ever really seriously considered it. Mm-hmm. I think academia affords me a level of flexibility, both in terms of working pattern And in terms of scientific research area, that I'm not sure I would get in an industry setting.
In industry, yeah. I'm mostly asking, of course, it's a good option, and there are a lot of people moving to industry, and there's a lot of great opportunities there. I mostly ask because I know a lot of people who want to stay in academia because of all this that you just mentioned, but they are in this position that they don't like the fact that it's not permanent, and they just, you know, I wanted to see how you looked at it to give some hope to people who want to stay.
I think resilience, you need to be resilient to stay in academia, right? You need to be able to take knockbacks.
Absolutely, yeah.
I applied for lots of fellowships and I didn't get them. And yet I still carried on applying, and then I got one. So,
yeah, it's very competitive. So it's, amazing. Have you faced any obstacles or biases as a woman in academia?
I think there are obstacles, there are biases that are there as a woman in academia, and also as a parent in academia. Being the only woman in the room at the table, I would say, happens not often, but does still happen. Having feedback and comments on a CV about lack of productivity because of maternity leave breaks and these type of things. It has happened to me. I think it happens less now. So I think the culture is shifting most definitely in terms of women and parents in academia. And there's also quite a lot of support that's available in that area as well. Not that it has completely rebalanced, but it's getting better.
Thank you. What strategies have you found effective for maintaining a productive work-life balance in academia?
I laugh because I wonder now if my family hear this recording, if they will agree.
Yeah, don't lie, Heather.
I think when it comes to work-life balance in academia, I think it, there's a couple of things. So I think the first thing is that what works for me is unlikely to work for somebody else, that everybody needs to find what their own work-life balance is. Mm-hmm. And hand in hand with that, the kind of career aspect of that is, my career path is not the same as anybody else's. And so comparing myself to other people, and perhaps then thinking I need to work longer, I need to work harder, I need to work more, is not productive at all. And so you are on your career path, and you find what works for you for your work-life balance. As I said, I really, really value the flexibility. And so not having to be in the building at certain hours, not having to work at certain hours, being able to work on my own terms from wherever I want to work, especially now post-pandemic. And that's more and more important to me with having a family and not wanting to miss out on those sports matches or those music performances or anything like that. And yet knowing that, of course, I need to do the academic work, I need to do the research, the teaching, and everything else. And so finding a way which works for you and your family. And I guess the one other thing is prioritizing. Mm-hmm. So I have a long list of things which in theory I'm past the deadline on, but I kind of know that that's a deadline that can slip. And so I've prioritized other things. I think getting good at that prioritization, and you get it wrong sometimes, and I most definitely have, and then you need to learn from that.
Yeah, it makes sense, because a lot of times you have a list of priorities and the actual priorities are too many and they don't fit in a few days, so it's crazy. So did you have a lot of teaching responsibilities as well, and how did you balance that with research?
So the teaching responsibilities I've got are mainly at the master's level. So I have more and more actually at the undergraduate level as well, but mainly at the master's level in terms of delivering teaching. But then I guess the thing that I wasn't aware of as an early career researcher is that teaching is not just delivering the lecture or even just preparing that lecture. It's actually marking as well, and facilitation of group discussions or running tutorials. Being a tutor for students, both one-to-one and in groups. It's interviewing for undergraduate students. And so there's quite a lot more to teaching than I think maybe most ECRs realise, that it's not just the actual delivery of teaching.
This is so true. I mean, even from the teaching experience that we can gain as ECRs, we realize that. But I can imagine when you're a professor, you have more modules to, you know, to teach, etc. It would be very takes a lot of time. You mentioned collaborations. Can you talk about any collaborative research projects that you've been involved and the benefits of such collaborations?
So I think collaboration is really key, and Nicoletta, actually you mentioned it in terms of the support that you get when you're putting in your fellowships. And I think that it's really key at that stage. So being able to show that you've formed new collaborations and that you've got something out of them, or not necessarily you, but there's something that's come out of those collaborations, is really, really important. And that continues to be important then as you progress along the academic career pathway. Yeah. Because academia is no longer working in a silo, burying your head and carrying on things. It's absolutely working together with others. So one example, which is quite new, she's running at the moment. So I'm a co-lead of an international network called the PDAge Network, which is funded by the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And that is a network of 35, I think, at the moment, and growing, scientists from across the world who are interested in Parkinson's and aging. And they might be experts in one aspect of those, but not necessarily both of them. And really, the key thing about that network is to try and reach some kind of a consensus as to how we should measure aging in models of Parkinson's, whether they be rodent models or whether they be patient-derived models, which is the area that I'm particularly interested in, with a view then at the end of that network to then actually have decided, okay, these are some key pieces of research which need to be undertaken. And that research will also be in a collaborative network, collaborative way. So
that's really interesting. Are there any specific network opportunities or conferences you recommend attending to enhance one's academic career? You mentioned this network you are at now. Are there any else in mind?
I think in terms of finding collaborations and building networks, then attending conferences is really key for that. And if you can't attend a particular conference, but you know someone is speaking at that conference, then reach out to them via email and make that connection and say, oh, you know, I really wanted to attend the British Neuroscience Association conference this year, but I was unable to. I see you were speaking at it. You know, I'm really interested in the area that you work in. Most people will reply to those type of emails that reach out to them to start a collaboration or initiate that collaboration. And so I think the piece of advice would be attend the conferences that you can, but don't feel that just because you haven't attended them, you can't reach out and make that link anyway.
Since we're at an UK mentorship scheme related podcast, let's ask a few questions related to mentorship as well. What role did mentors or advisors play in your academic development? How did they contribute to your success?
So I think mentoring has been really important to me throughout my career. So when I was a postdoc, applying for fellowships. Then there was a mentoring scheme set up at Sheffield. And I was one of the first cohorts of mentees that went through that mentorship. And that was really key to me. The thing which was particularly good actually about that is I had one mentor, my first mentor on it, and that relationship lasted 6 months, as was planned in the scheme. And then I went back to the scheme after that relationship had finished and said, okay, I'm at another stage now. I think I need something else from a mentor. Can you rematch me with somebody else? And so I was matched with a different mentor, and that mentor then was my mentor for the, probably 10 years or more of that relationship.
Wow, amazing.
So all the way through applying for fellowships, getting the fellowship, building my research team, getting additional funding, diversifying the funding portfolio, incorporating teaching, research, admin, everything else that comes with that. And then, of course, not just building the research team, but managing a research team. So currently my group is 17 people. That's quite a lot to manage. And so that mentor has kind of been with me the whole way through all of that. And in addition to that mentor, then I've also had several other mentors. So some of them formal via other schemes from outside of Sheffield, and then some of them informal, that are just people that I have got to know throughout being in academia. And then I know there are people that I can reach out to and have those mentoring conversations when I need to. And I think because I see it as being really, really key to my own development and well-being, that's why I have then been actively involved in being a mentor now for other people. So I've mentored lots of people on that, on the Sheffield scheme that I was the original mentee on, on this Alzheimer's mentoring scheme, also for the Future Leaders scheme. You're welcome. The Future Leaders FLF scheme, and several other schemes.
Wow. So I think how do you manage all of these?
that's where it comes to the flexibility.
Let's not go back to the work-life balance then. The question. I know obviously, but I wanted to ask you as well, what is your approach to mentoring and supporting students?
I think the approach to mentoring is you need to be good at listening. And so I always find the best as a mentee, when I go into a meeting with my mentor, somehow or another, I do all the talking and I come up with the solutions or the different ways in which I can handle a situation that I might be discussing myself, just with a couple of key or strategic questions from my mentor. And that's something that I try to do as a mentor. And you know, Nicoletta, just from this podcast interview, but as well, I sometimes have a tendency to talk a lot, but I really try in the mentoring situations to listen and just, I can tell people my experiences, but then ask strategic questions to get the mentee to think about how they might handle and approach those situations themselves.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, how was your experience through the pandemic? How did you work through that? And if it had any effect on your work?
Obviously, it was a massive change for everybody, myself included. Huge change. All of a sudden going to have to being at home, managing a team who could not get into the laboratory to do experiments because the laboratories were closed. And then when they did open, obviously it was shift work and I was still not allowed to be on site and various things. So huge, huge challenges that everybody was facing. So I already said then that I have two children, so homeschooling two children at the same time. And so I look back on it now and I'm not entirely sure how we got through it, if I'm honest. Somehow or other, we got through it. The children managed to get some schoolwork done. I managed to get some work done. The team managed to all be okay. and also get some research done. It's not an experience that I would want to go back to. And I think it has made me, from a work point of view as well as a home point of view, really value a social interaction.
Yeah, I think nobody wants to go back to that. I remember that it was one day that we just told stop all the experiments, and I had to throw away like 4 months of work. But yeah, I can imagine for people who have families, have a lot more to manage. So it's impressive that you want to do that, because in 2021, it was when you were promoted to professor, right? During the pandemic as well. So you managed to do that during this period. It's amazing. So one last question before we go to the next section. What part of your job most excites you? What motivates you? I think I know the answer, but...
I'm excited and motivated because I get to learn new things. I get to find new things out. And that's the thing that intrigued me and really got me hooked on science and medical translational research to begin with. And that's still the thing that I find the most motivating. I think the additional thing that I have now in my role, which I do find really motivating, is that I get to have an impact, hopefully a positive one, on building the future generations of researchers. And so that's an added motivation for me.
Actually, I just thought about another question, because I know that you are really involved with public and patient involvement. So would you like to share your experience? Because I know you have a lot of it.
So I'm not clinically trained, and yet I really, really have wanted to work in translational neuroscience research throughout my career. And so as a postdoc, that's something that I got involved with, because I realized that I was working on these conditions and yet I didn't actually know people with the conditions. I'd not met them. So I started going out to local branches, meeting people affected by conditions, and going back then year after year to the same branch as well and meeting people again and really building a relationship. So not just then telling them about my research, but having a two-way conversation with them about the research and getting their input into the research. And from that then I've really kind of developed a keen interest in making people aware that actually public patient involvement, not just engagement, but involvement, is actually meaningful in laboratory or preclinical research as well. And so there's various ways and methods that can happen. And I've sat on the Parkinson's UK steering group for that, for example. I've also run training sessions, and I teach on that for the master's students and for the PhD students here in Sheffield. And also then do some training for that specifically with some industry partners and things as well. So I think it's really key to get, if you're dedicating all of your time to researching a particular condition, actually there is no one better than someone living with the condition.
So a few months ago, we started at the DRI, the Dementia Research Institute of Cardiff, we started a seminar series of ambassador talks. So we have people diagnosed with a disease or carers who come and give us a talk about their experience, and that has been amazing for us. So useful. And then we sit down for an hour or more with them and have a discussion, have a tea and coffee, and it has been really, really inspiring for us and very important. And we recently had a showcase event at the DRI as well. There were a lot of people visited us, and they were all so enthusiastic to be involved, to visit the labs, to take part in different brain games, and to ask us about our lives as researchers. And it was so amazing. I'm like, we should do this more often. And there were even people, because I also work with donor-derived stem cell lines, there were people who asked me if they can donate blood to be screened. And it was really amazing, yeah.
I think that all, and those interactions by far and away are really positive. They're really motivating and inspiring, as you said. And those people, of course, know the most about those conditions. Mm-hmm. They're living with them every day.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that we don't think about, and then we discuss with them, and it's amazing. Yeah.
Just on that point, the other thing that I do, I used to do a lot more often, but I still do now, is going into schools and to teaching them about the brain and about different brain cell types, about mitochondria, of course. as well, but I think that's hugely important and really motivating for me. And I remember that there was one little girl who then saw me several months later, and she said, "You came in and you told me what a neuron was and what a neuron does, and now I know that I can be a scientist like you if I want to be."
It's amazing that when you describe your work and when you describe specific parts of the world, they visit the lab as well. And then they realize that, you know, they can do that. So it's very important. So now we know about your career. Thank you very much. You answered to so many questions. It's time now to get to some speedy career and life tips. In this part of the show, we're going to have some quick-fire career questions, short, snappy answers. Ready?
Ready.
What's one thing you wish someone had told you when you were the career stage I am currently?
Don't give up. That if you want it and put in enough applications, you will get that.
How do you collaborate with other scientists or researchers, and what do you think are the most important qualities for successful collaborations?
I think for successful collaborations, then you need to both be on board with the collaboration. So you both need to be invested in the collaboration, and both be able to see what impact or outcome it will have that will benefit both of you. So I think they're the most successful ones that are duly beneficial.
Next question. You have a super impressive track record at writing successful grants. What's the secret to your success?
I think any grant needs to be read by as many people and get feedback from as many people as you possibly can. That goes for fellowship applications and project grants, subsequent grants to any funder. Feedback, feedback, feedback.
I'm going to send you mine then. I'd also like to hear the other side of this and how you deal with failure or rejection.
So I think that's never easy to deal with failure and rejection. And I would say, at the moment, it's a case of the first day or so being a little disgruntled about the rejection, but then looking at any comments that you get, or looking at going back to the application yourself, looking at it with a fresh pair of eyes. And I always find ways in which I could improve it. And so it's then about looking for the positives and ways in which things could be improved.
What do you think is the best way to get students interested in science? And what is the best thing about being a scientist?
The best way to get students interested in science, I think it's about telling them, showing them some of the things that are possible. And one of the best things about being a scientist is that it doesn't ever stand still. And so what is possible now, actually, if you're a scientist, you can go on and develop something or find out something new so that new things are possible. And so I think those two things go quite nicely hand in hand.
So I'll finish with a fun one. Do you have any lab superstitions?
So I'm not in the lab very often myself anymore. But I had a lab superstition when I was doing my PhD that I would only do a particular assay to measure mitochondrial respiratory chain activity with one piece of music on in the background.
Really? So can you please share with us what this piece of music was?
It was the soundtrack to Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'll try that and let you know how it went. Thank you, Heather. So that's it. That was the last one, the last question. Let me recap on the main takeaways. So Heather has had a fantastic career, as you heard, and this allowed her to pick up skills from working in the UK and abroad. She thinks that we should explore all the opportunities available, see what is best for us and embrace it, follow our interests, where they take us, follow our research passion. Develop our ideas, talk to people, network, and be open to collaborations and find a mentor. Heather also thinks that it's always a great idea to be involved in public and patient engagement and involvement. We're now in the last segment of the show, and before we finish, we just want to talk a little about mentoring. Why did you decide to be a mentor, and what advice would you have for anyone listening who doesn't have a mentor?
I decided to be a mentor because I've benefited so much from mentoring myself, and I would like to give a little bit back that way. I think if you don't have a mentor now, then I would say definitely explore it. And even if perhaps your first experience of mentoring isn't great, then I wouldn't give up on it, because I think that the mentoring experience can be different depending on the mentee-mentor relationship and also the setup of the mentoring scheme that you enroll in.
Thank you. I think we covered questions about mentorship earlier as well, because I asked you how it impacted your own personal and professional growth. If you could choose anyone alive or dead to be your mentor, who would you choose?
Oh, this is so, so difficult. I was thinking about this for such a long time, and I'm going to be really flaky, and I'm going to say that I just genuinely don't think I could choose one single person. I would like to have a mentoring conversation with so many people. I just don't think I can choose. Sorry.
I totally understand. I'm the same. I can't choose one person. There's so many people, dead or alive, people I know, people, you know, that I've met during my academic career. So I understand that. And last question. If you couldn't be a researcher, what would you be instead?
When I was younger, I did want to be, for quite a long time, a jet pilot. I looked at that quite seriously as a career path. So I think if I couldn't be a researcher, it would be that.
Well, that is all we have time for today. I would like to give a massive thank you to my amazing mentor and guest, Professor Heather Mortebois. I hope you had a nice time, Heather.
Thank you so much, Nicoletta. It was such a pleasure speaking to you, and I've really, really enjoyed the conversations.
Oh, thank you. Good. I'm glad you did. I did enjoy it very much too. If you'd like to find out more about Heather and her work, you can find her bio on the Dementia Researcher website. You can also find my bio there. The Ask Your Mentor podcast will be back soon with another mentee talking to their mentor. Thank you all for watching our podcast. But for now, I'm off to plan my career. I'm Nicoletta Dasquilidou, and you've been listening to the Ask Your Mentor podcast from Dementia Researcher in association with Alzheimer's Research UK. Thank you. Bye.